Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. We're very pleased to have today Jennifer Bunner to talk about Mormonism. I might mention that we're focusing on mainstream Mormonism. There are some far-out things that we can talk about after we're done with the program, if you like. But let me just introduce Jennifer. Jennifer Bunner was born in Morgantown, West Virginia, to Mormon parents who both converted to the LDS Church as young adults. She and her four sisters were raised Mormon, both in West Virginia and then after they moved to Wisconsin in 1990. Both of her parents held several positions within the church over the years as they grew up, and she did once she reached her teens in the young adult program. She became dissatisfied with the church in her late teens and stopped going at age 18. She became an atheist shortly thereafter, since arguments against the Mormon religion and concept of God seemed to be applied equally to other religions and concepts of God. About 4 years later, she formally resigned from the church, a more difficult than expected process. Perhaps we'll hear more about that later. Her grown siblings now seem to have little or no involvement with the LDS Church, and at least one of them is now an atheist as well. Mormons are assigned to the particular ward, that is, congregation, based on where they live. They don't choose their own church. So while they lived in the Oregon area, that her family attended the LDS Church in Madison on Regent near Segal. So welcome, Jennifer Bunner, and thank you for coming.
This is my father. He knows a lot more about Mormon history than I do, so he's here to help me. Okay, I really don't have anything formally prepared, so if anyone wants to just ask questions or anything, I can talk on that subject.
Do you want to talk about your earlier, what do you remember from West Virginia?
Well, there's only one ward in West Virginia, I mean, in Morgantown, West Virginia, so everybody in the Morgantown area went to that one church. It was fairly small. It's gotten a lot bigger now.
Three wards now.
Oh, okay. And it was a fairly close-knit ward, I believe. Since Morgantown is a college town, there were several people there from the university. And so there were a lot of very intelligent people there. I mean, not that Mormons aren't intelligent in general. They have a very high rate of college education. But there were professors there. And a lot.
There were the chair of public administration was a member, the dean of the law school, two physics professors at West Virginia University, who one later went on to become the state president. And then two professor of chemical engineering and a mathematics professor. So
the zoology. Ward,
and zoology professor, yes. And so there were about half of the ward were actually affiliated with being professors at the university.
Jennifer, do you want to explain to people, if they haven't done some basic reading, the structure, you know, from the wards? People, like, we're throwing that term around, but there may be people who don't even know what a ward is.
Sure. A ward is like a congregation. The ward is, you know, they all come to the church at the same time. And it's basically just a congregation. It's headed by a bishop who, all positions are volunteered positions, none of them are paid. And so, like, a bishop will be called for a few years, and then another one will be called, as well as the people under the bishop, the clerk, the down to teachers in the primary system for children. Wards are gathered into a stake. The Madison stake has 14 wards in it, and there are 6 stakes in Wisconsin. And they get together for like a stake conference. Is it once a year?
Twice
a year. And that's headed by a stake president. And after that, is there a regional?
And loosely, there's a regional, but it's not really much organization there.
Right. And then the head of it all is in Washington. I mean, Salt Lake City, and that's the prophet who's the president of the church, his the 12 apostles underneath him, and then the quorum of the 70, who, well, there's the first quorum and the second quorum. Mm-hmm. And each of them, are each of them assigned a stake, or?
Stakes are assigned, yes.
Yeah, under them. So, like.
If an individual congregation with all of these university people decide to think for themselves a little bit, what kind of authority comes down out of Salt Lake City and says, no, you can't keep
something? Well, it would be the stake president first. I mean, it would go very high to the top very quickly, I think,
so
in that circumstance.
Is there a certain uniformity and rigidity, shall I say, in the,
yes.
All the congregations?
Yes, it's very controlled.
Yeah, there have been disciplinary actions against individuals, certainly, but I'm actually unaware of any ward on its own having broken away or ever having a mass disciplinary action. I've never heard of such a thing.
What about the RLDS?
That broke away very early.
I know.
Right, yeah.
They broke away.
Yeah.
They don't even exist technically anymore.
And they changed their name. Yeah.
The Communities of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're based in Missouri.
Right. Well, there's also the FLDS. They pretty much.
There's over 100
yeah.
branches.
That's not centralized. Off, so. Mm-hmm.
Of what? Mormonism?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I understand they make a very small percentage make of the total Mormon.
Yes.
Well, how many of these 100 have
one
headquarters in Utah?
What about that?
How many of the 100 would have headquarters in Utah?
The main body of the church known, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known as the Mormons, make up 80 to 85% or more of the total people who claimed to believe in the Book of Mormon. If you use that as a definitive separator from normal Christianity, you would say probably 90% total would be within the main body of the church that you normally, the Mitt Romney, the, you know, the public specter of the, you know, of what you recognize as the Mormon church. But split off groups, there's been many, many, many over the years, most of them very small. And
without representation in Utah.
Well, they many of them, when they split off, select their own prophet. And he leads them into, you know, and so they have nothing to do. And if you go back into the 19th century, it was sort of known as the Brighamites. Those are the ones who went to Utah. And then you had the reorganized church that basically formed around Nauvoo and drifted down to Independence, Missouri. And then those were the two main bodies. And then across time, they just had, well, when the what was known as the RLDS Church instituted the priesthood for women. They had several. They must have had 20 break-off groups when they did that. Yeah. And so they've had a lot, both, and then on the LDS side, when they disavowed polygamy, there were many, many break-off groups who still wanted to carry that forward.
Which Romney's...
Romney's own...
Yes, which is why his father was born in Mexico, because they fled down to Mexico.
That was actually a legitimate LDS settlement, because the LDS church formed small communities just across the border in Cardston, Alberta, into Canada, and just across the border into Mexico, so they would be outside of U.S. law. And Romney's parents were loyal, faithful members of the main body of the LDS Church under Brigham Young, but they lived in Mexico, as they were called and sent to do, and so that's where they're actually like from New England who moved to Utah, who were sent to colonize Mexico, but they weren't really Mexicans, mm-hmm. You know,
sure.
They just lived like a few miles over the border.
Could you go over, you know, the Book of Mormon, the origins of it, and kind of some of the basic tenets that are in it?
Sure. The Book of Mormon, it was, well, the first, let's see where I start here. Joseph Smith was the one that translated the Book of Mormon and received the Book of Mormon. they were, he was 14 years old, the official story, he was 14 years old. He wanted to know which church to join, and he prayed in what is now called the Sacred Grove, which is a group of trees in Palmyra, New York. And he had a vision. Jesus Christ and God appeared to him, told him that none of the churches were correct, and that he should join none of them. Did they call him at that time to?
No.
And they kind of left it at that point. Later on, the prophet Moroni, who is a figure in the Book of Mormon, he appeared to him, told him that there were golden plates in which a history of the Jews in America, basically, were written, and over several years eventually had him go and dig up the golden plates out of a hill in Palmyra, New York, and translate them. After he translated them, the angel took them back into heaven, so we don't have the originals. They were said to be written in Reformed Egyptian, which isn't really...
That's not a Joseph Smith claim, actually. That's there's a story that a person who was assisting him in the translation by the name of Martin Harris had Joseph copy onto a piece of paper some of the ancient symbols supposedly that were in the golden plates. He took that to a professor of languages in New York City called Charles Anton, who looked at it and he said it's Reformed Egyptian. But then he later denied it. But
that's what's known as hieratics, isn't it?
Yeah.
As opposed to hieroglyphics.
Yes. Yeah. And so there actually are still extant copies of that, of those copied symbols. But Joseph Smith himself never claimed that it was a Reformed Egyptian, but he did say it was an ancient language carved into golden plates that were bound. And
it is taught today in the church. It is called Reformed Egyptian,
yeah,
in Sunday school. He gained several followers. He organized a church and was 1830.
April 1830.
1830, yeah. And eventually, I'm not sure of the church in New York as much as I am in after that.
Well, they had a small following in upstate New York, and only six people, I think, were original members. And they proselytized, and they had 3,000 copies of the Book of Mormon printed up, funded by Martin Harris. That's why he had the language studied, so he was funding the printing. And they went out as missionaries to proselyte and get more people to join, and they were having some success, but not a lot, until some missionaries went to Kirtland, Ohio, and encountered a preacher by the name of Sidney Rigdon, who had a congregation there, and converted him and nearly his whole congregation, like 150 some people. And then the missionaries came back with Sidney Rigdon and persuaded that should be that Joseph Smith and his followers in New York should move there to really form a center place for the church. And so they it's just down the Erie Canal and down around into Ohio, and so that's where the church went. They moved there 1831, 1832, right through there.
And it's still there, I think.
The temple they built is still there.
Yeah, and some of the buildings, some of the houses they built are still, it's a tourist. You can go there and tour Kirtland, Ohio to see the early church history, yes.
It's owned by the former Reorganized Church.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So if you go there, you see kind of their take on it all.
Right.
Which is slightly different.
There's an interesting book about some deranged guy, and I think it was in the 1980s, that formed his own cult based out of the Kirkland community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From there, it was a bank failure, wasn't it, that led to them?
Well, it was a national thing. There was an 1837 financial collapse in the United States, mm-hmm. and a lot of that was because we didn't have... Our monetary system wasn't very stabilized. We didn't have Federal Reserve banks and stuff. And so individual banks and communities could actually print money. But you had to get state charters and stuff to do that. But it was a very loose-knit financial system everywhere. And the church applied to the state of Ohio to print Kirtland Safety Society notes, which were money, supposedly backed by gold. And Ohio turned them down. And so they printed, they took all the notes they'd already had printed and they stamped, hand-stamped, anti-banking society. And then issued them anyway. And then some of the people who didn't like Joseph Smith and who were on the outs with him immediately rushed the bank to redeem them in gold. And they did have some gold, but they didn't have anywhere near enough the bank. And so they drained it and the bottom fell out of that currency. And so, yes, they had an absolute total financial collapse within that society in Kirtland.
Yeah, example of what the good of small government.
Yeah, exactly. And that happened in many places, you know, that these non-backed securities failed during that financial panic.
So the financial scandal in Kirtland led to them moving to another state?
To Mississippi.
They had already...
Or not Mississippi, Missouri. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Independence, Missouri, they had already sent missionaries out prior to that and had established a second center in Independence. Had, I don't know, a few hundred members out there. And when that collapsed in Kirtland, many of them then fled to Independence.
They encountered a lot of trouble in Independence, partially because they were anti-slavery, and they also tended to vote as a block. And so they could move into a town and change the politics of that town a lot. Joseph Smith was first jailed in Independence.
I thought that was Nauvoo.
He was also jailed in Nauvoo, but he was first jailed in Independence.
Independence.
Liberty.
Yeah, Liberty Jail.
They started flooding into Independence. They were actually driven out by the settlers there because Independence was like a gathering point for people going west, and it was big. And so the governor of Missouri, which is in a, you know, you're talking about lack of freedom of religion, actually gave the Mormons a county. It was Caldwell County, and said, "Stay there. Move all your people into Caldwell County." And there were too many of them coming in from Ohio, and they were actually successfully converting people, and they outgrew Caldwell County and spread into Davis County and other counties in Missouri. And the people there, the Missourians were frontier. It was 1830s, and they didn't want Mormons. And so they started harassing them, and they started, you know, and they, on elections, they actually blocked Mormons from voting. And there was tremendous friction, and there were some gunfire incidents, and then eventually it led to a full-scale uprising.
Well, there was a governor of Missouri in that period.
Lillian Boggs.
Genocide of them.
Lillian Boggs, yes.
Right.
He actually eventually issued a proclamation that banned Mormons from living in Missouri, which wasn't repealed until the 1990s.
Getting back to your personal experience, what sort of religious education program did you have? And how did you feel about it as you went from ages 5 or 6 up to 12 or 15?
Well, from 2 years old, isn't it 2 years? That's when
18 months you go in the nursery and 3 years you go in the sunbeams or something.
Right. Yeah, from very early on, there are specific classes that you have in the primary program, which goes from 18 months or 3 years, I guess, with nursery separate, until 12. And there are several classes up, it's called primary. You go from like sunbeams to CTRs, or which is choose the right. They have names for them, you move through. And it's, I mean, very young, obviously, you just play games and tell you, you know, very little kids things, but it's all, you go there for an hour in the basic classes and then another amount of time. I don't remember the exact, it's been a long time. But, and then you go into a more general class.
About 45 where, minutes each, I think.
Yeah. With all the people in your age group, like, and yeah, older primary, younger primary, and you learn songs and things. And those are, I think, basically like children's Sunday school classes everywhere. It's just very basic doctrine is taught, a lot through songs and stories, things like that. Once you turn 12, you go into the young adult program, and there's young women's and young men's. They're split off. First, there's a Sunday school that I think goes for the same 45 minutes, and then you go split into your male and female classes. The males get priesthood at that point, and the females just go into the young women's program, where they again move up through classes. And that's where you get your first callings. I was Beehive president. Beehive is a symbol of Utah. And that has more detailed discussions, church history. Every 4 years you switch, or every year you switch books. So you go, there's four holy books. Go Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, and the Bible. Or do they split Old and New Testament? I think they do.
With the current, they've changed. They change every once in a while. Oh. But about the last 15 years or so, they do have a 4-year instruction cycle for teenagers and then the adults, right. and they go through Old Testament, New Testament, church history, which is Doctrine and Covenants, and Book of Mormon. Mm.
So. And would you say, I don't want to put words in your mouth, would you say it's a fairly didactic method of teaching rather than a discussion?
I think there's a fair amount of discussion allowed. They do have manuals, and so most teachers who teach from the manual and ask, the same questions.
Well, when you began to have some doubts, were you still of that age group?
Yes.
But how were your doubts treated?
I don't think I brought up my doubts much in the Sunday schools. I mostly did in seminary, which is an after-school program, though since we live so far out of town, we did it once a week. And they were passed over very quickly and ignored. It was, I remember once one of the standard questions was, why don't women get the priesthood? And my answer was, well, I think they should, in that the teacher said, and switch to another person, ask the same question, who gave the correct answer. And she didn't really talk about it any more than that.
Do the Mormons, they still have the family night too, could you say a little
yes.
about that?
Well, once a week, usually yeah. Mondays, you're supposed to have family home evening.
Right.
There are family home evening manuals, though you don't have to follow them. A lot of times it's just a fun activity. But you're supposed to just get together as a family and do some faith-promoting activity.
Could you explain the different levels of heaven spelled out in the
sure.
Book of Mormon?
Sure. There are three levels of glory plus outer darkness. Outer darkness is where you go if you're really bad. I believe suicides go there, and people who blaspheme against the Holy Spirit, which basically means turn away from God, have God have the true knowledge and then turn away from it. And then it goes telestial, terrestrial, and celestial. Telestial is for basically what most people would think of as hell. It is murderers would go there mostly, rapists, I guess. It's the lowest of the glory, but it's still a form of glory, and it's still better than being on earth.
Yeah, there's no torture taught in the, right. in there's no burning hell that's taught within the Mormon church. It's all in the Doctrine and Covenants, too. It's none right. of that's in the Book of Mormon.
Right.
Yep.
But it is still an official book of the Mormon
yes.
church. Your main punishment is not being with other holy people, not being in the presence of God. Terrestrial is the middle one. It's mostly just non-believers, people who haven't done anything real bad but have not accepted the Mormon religion.
That would include the Gentiles, so-called?
Right, mm-hmm. right. Celestial is the believers. And believers that have lived up to their faith. You know, just because you're baptized doesn't mean you go to the celestial kingdom. You also have to live the tenets of Mormonism. Now, you don't go there until after the judgment day, so right after you die, you would go to the spirit world, the afterlife. And while you're there, if you're a Gentile, you can convert to Mormonism. They do send missionaries down from kind of the Mormon part of the spirit world, and you can convert. So everybody will have the chance, is what they tell you.
Posthumous proselytizing.
Right, and that's why they do baptisms for the dead, is for those people, if they have accepted it in the afterlife, they will get to go to the celestial kingdom.
How would anybody know if they had done that in the afterlife?
They don't know. That's why they baptize everybody for the dead, and then the ones that accept it will have that baptism and be able to go.
Which heaven do they go?
The celestial kingdom, yes.
And is the top level?
That's guaranteed for them.
We heard the missionary saying about having his own planet. The top level is what you have to achieve to become god of your own planet?
Yes. Yes.
And what will happen to you if you die tonight?
I would go to outer darkness. Eventually, I would go to outer darkness because I'm.
That's actually an unknown.
Is
in
it?
The Mormon, according to official Mormon doctrine, because nobody can know exactly what you knew. You know, their point. You know, as a human, you know, the official doctrine would be that only God can look within a person's soul and determine if they actually knew the truth absolutely and then denied it, knowing the truth. And so it's up to God to determine that.
I was laughing at the I that she said, as opposed to the you. that was the reaction that I was having.
Yeah. So the official doctrine would hold that not that many people would actually ever go to outer darkness,
right.
and nobody on this earth would ever be in a proper position to judge anyone as to where they would be.
LDS has a whole set of documents and histories and liturgy that goes. Is it possible to sort of move away from that and come up with 3 or 5 or 10 or whatever basic things that Mormons believe in that's not attached to the dogma per se, ethics or moral principles or whatever?
Well, one of the big ones is that they believe in continuous revelation, both to individuals on personal level and to the church through the prophet. And so that's a big part of Mormonism that we don't just look to the Bible or even the Book of Mormon, but to church proclamations in general, that it's ongoing.
Right.
Another one is the emphasis on families, and that families, the refrain, families are together forever, that marriage and family isn't just for until death do part, but if everybody is faithful, they will get to be together in the spirit world as well and have spiritual children together. And that's why there are temples to seal couples together. And they are sealed when you get married, both in heaven, both on earth and in heaven.
And that's true no matter how many wives are involved.
Well, a man can be sealed to multiple wives. A woman, even if her husband is dead, can't be sealed to him after she's been sealed to one man.
She can't marry again?
She can marry, but she won't be sealed to them.
So those guys are just drifting off in some other afterlife.
Well,
without a spouse.
They can be assigned wives in heaven. So
you can have what?
You can. Oy. There can be marriage and like assigning of wives in heaven.
I think the basic Mormon perspective would be that if everyone who is in the celestial kingdom will be sealed to somebody. There will be no singles in the celestial kingdom.
Has the church recognized divorce?
You can get divorced, and there are two processes. There's to be divorced, to be unsealed, you have to go through a formal process with the church hierarchy, I believe. You go through a special process. It's not automatic just because you get divorced in, you know, secularly.
Is that easier than getting excommunicated?
Divorce?
Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah, absolutely. There's not that many excommunications.
Yeah.
Were you excommunicated or did you just withdraw?
I withdrew. They tried to excommunicate me. They tried to hold in a court. They have this whole system of doing it, but I refused to go, and eventually they stopped trying to gather evidence and just let me go.
Surprised they didn't do it in absentia or something.
That's all done at a local level, and so it's not even-handed from ward to ward. Okay. I mean, they try to do teaching and training and hold, and there's guidebooks about how to deal, but you can have an individual bishop who's a very hardliner, very conservative, who will crack the whip on things that another bishop would never dream of. And so you do have some unevenness. And it'll change within the same ward as soon as the bishop changes. You can.
So my brother had a friend who withdrew from the church, and his family was basically told to have no contact with him. So that would be like a hardliner.
Yeah, that's not official church. Yeah,
that would official church doctrine would never say to do that.
Okay. Right.
Family's too important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's always the hope that you'd come back to the church too. So.
It appears every president brings with him his religion. President of USA brings the religion, his religion, particular religion, and has an influence in the country, in his particular region. If Romney should win the presidency, what should we expect from Romney as a Mormon to have upon the United States?
Well, there have been other government officials that have gotten very high. One of the presidents of the church, the prophet, was Secretary of Agriculture at one point.
Benson,
yes. One thing.
And there's certainly been several governors.
Yeah.
Well,
Romney. In Massachusetts.
Yes. Yes. Obviously, like Harry Reid is a Mormon as well.
His dad in Michigan.
Yeah. A few senators like Paul Laxalt.
Right.
So, what could you give me an idea of what to expect?
Well, it really depends on the individual, I think. Uh-huh. One thing about Mormonism is that at the base, they do believe in a theocracy. They do believe that the church structure in Utah will eventually merge with the United States government. I don't think Romney would be operating on that, on any higher level, but it is something in the background. Yeah. I mean, obviously people like Romney and Harry Reid are very different on how they would approach a situation like that, so I really think it depends on the individual. In
both of them aren't very good Mormons, are they?
What?
They're not very good Mormons in a lot of ways.
I mean, Romney was
a state
bishop,
president.
And, he is very strong.
Did you guys see the Doonesbury Cartoon Week where Romney was in Paris and proselytizing?
No, I didn't.
Another good example would be John Huntsman. John Huntsman was a Republican presidential candidate this year, and he's ex-governor of Utah, and he is a Mormon. He's also Barack Obama's ambassador to China, and he is much more open-minded, moderate.
And the Udalls.
Very different. Yep.
The Udall family.
Udalls.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Much more progressive than that.
Can you give us a sense of where a bishop is in the hierarchy? How many is a bishop? Does every ward have a bishop?
Yes, it would be like kind of the pastor of a church.
Yes. I think the monks do that too.
You mean, okay.
The leader of the congregation and the monks is called the bishop.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So there's only one bishop per ward?
Yes, but it's rotating you know.
Oh, okay.
Typically, it's six to seven years.
No.
Okay.
The bishop position, and that's an unpaid position.
Right. All the positions.
Every position in the church, except for like janitors and stuff.
Right. And even really? The prophet. The
all the religious positions are all unpaid. Even the prophet.
Yeah.
Even the prophet?
Yes.
Yeah, the president of the church receives nothing from the church.
Usually, if you make it that high, though, you've done pretty well in business.
And wealthy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not always, though. Some of them really skip by of high-level positions.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. I mean, they have their church expenses paid,
yeah.
You right. know, travel and stuff like that, but I mean, you're really on your own.
Uh-huh. So I know one of the recent presidents, I think it was Gordon Hinckley, he was a railroad executive or mm-hmm. something.
Yeah, when the rest of the Mormons would shun a person who had backslid or left mm-hmm. the faith, would that have material consequences too? Would that person
it could,
have trouble getting a job? And
it definitely could in Utah, in some of the small towns where everyone's Mormon. There have been a lot of stories about things like that.
There's not supposed to be an official
right.
shunning. This is just humans being humans.
Right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
of the old stories about terrible persecution.
Oh yes,
of those who left.
Definitely,
right.
And especially in the very early church.
Well, one of the kind of Elts novelettes was about somebody.
Sign of Gloria.
Is that what they call Jack Mormon? That's something that's
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but haven't officially withdrawn from the church. So they're still a Mormon
right.
in name, but not uh-huh. in practice.
It's the easiest way out, I guess.
And so nobody knows which heaven they go to that's determined at judgment.
Excuse
the Jack Mormons
oh.
might be okay, depending on what the judgment was at judgment day.
Yeah, I mean, they say you should definitely go to church and everything, but a Jack Mormon theoretically could go to the celestial kingdom. Like my father said, we can't. The official line is that God will judge.
I had a friend who called himself a Jack Mormon, and he remained he and his wife remained members,
mm-hmm.
not active. Because one of their sons was born mentally defective,
mm-hmm.
and as an adult, he was sort of being taken care of by the Mormon Church.
They have a very strong social system,
welfare system. The parents kept their association with the church
mm-hmm.
for that reason.
Could you talk about the whole process of being a missionary and who assigns it, who goes,
mm-hmm.
All that? Because that's a very, I know when I visit in Utah, we have several friends who, and they're in, you know, that as their kids approach, that's of course the topic of conversation,
right.
is where they're going to go.
Right, and it's actually a very timely issue because they just changed the age at which women can go on missions.
Men too.
Oh, men too?
18 now.
Wasn't it 18 always?
No, it was 19.
Oh. Well, anyway, men are all expected to go on a mission, and that is assigned at a higher level of the church. They don't have any control over where they're going to go. Also, it's all funded by the family. The church doesn't mm-hmm. pay the way for that. It's a sacrifice that families are expected to make, is to send their children on.
Well,
send their sons on missions.
There's one caveat to that. There is a general missionary fund to which anyone can donate, and they help out those families who can't afford to pay at all.
So it's not just the rich. I mean, if you're
right.
poor, you still can go.
Right.
Everybody pays the exact same amount, too, no matter where you get sent.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. So if you're going very far afield, they
standardized it all, yes.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right.
So for some reason, very few women were called.
Well, women are, it's optional for them to go, and up until just a few days ago, really, women could go once they reached 21.
Uh-huh.
It was often joked that, well, if you're not married by then, that's what you do. You go on your mission. And that's how it worked a lot of times. Now they just changed it to 18 so that women...
Was women 19?
19.
I think women's 19,
oh,
male
was
18
it?
Now.
Well, it was much earlier. And so I think they're pushing more for women to go as a matter of course. It's very common, well, at BYU, a man would go for his first year of college, then they'd go on their missions, and they'd come back to BYU. That was just the accepted way you did things. Now it looks like women will be folded into that as well.
And men are going to go now a lot of times right out of high school, rather than have that 1 year in between.
Right, because it's 18 instead of 19.
Yeah.
So they're going, are you saying that the guys are going now straight out of high school and not
yes.
for a year at the university?
That's
right.
That's the change that was just enacted, yes.
Okay, so.
Right.
Subject
and
to negotiation, I suppose. Or is that for everybody? It's changed for everybody? Or is
it's
what's recommended?
It's recommended you wouldn't have to. If you want to be a missionary, they'd pretty much take you at any age, I'm sure. But that's what is expected of you. Also,
Jennifer talked about coming through the young adult classes all the way through the 6 years of the young men. They groom them to become missionaries.
Right.
And that's the main focus. It's the number one thing. It's what the programs are all about. It's all about getting as many of the 12 to 18-year-old boys as possible to serve a mission as soon as they're eligible. And in the women's program, there's almost no emphasis on serving
right.
a mission.
Yeah, they will talk about it, but it's mostly in terms of you want to marry a returned missionary. That's the big emphasis in women's.
And so any woman who wants to go on a mission, that was never denied. It's just
right.
that it was not encouraged either. Where within men, males, it was strongly, strongly encouraged. And one of the reasons for that even is if you look at the statistics, people who remain active, extreme difference between men who serve missions and men who don't. And the same thing for their families once they get married. There's an extreme statistical correlation between that.
So this is what holds people to the church.
Yes.
So
yes.
it's as much a ministry to yourself
right.
to
yes.
yourself
yes.
as
yes.
it is to
right.
the
they go undergo intense
community.
Training at
yes.
the missionary training
or
center for 6 months.
The people who are held to the church like Trump mm-hmm. might have self-selected themselves by committing to one.
That too.
Did you
yes.
serve as a missionary?
No.
Was that because you already at that age had some
time? I was already 20.
Well, you converted
two.
As an adult when you
yeah.
were originally.
Right. Do well, missionaries go in pairs?
Yes, they're assigned a partner, and those change throughout the mission. A mission lasts 18 months. And
2 years now.
Oh, is it? 2 years now. And they will send you, they'll send you to a particular district, missionary district, and within that, they'll pair you up, like a younger one will be paired with someone who's about to leave in a few months. Mm-hmm. And then when they go, they'll be paired with somebody else. So it's not consistent through the whole time, but they always will be in pairs, and they're not allowed to leave, not allowed to be in another building than their partner or anything. It's very, very strict.
Is there any position that the church has in terms of military service, killing people in the war, et cetera?
I've never heard of any.
The church was,
in
the 19th century, the church was very pacifist. Stood out of the Civil War. Barely got involved. And then even in the Reconstruction period, it was very pacifist. Leading up to about the Spanish-American War era. But that's when the church, with all the intense scrutiny about polygamy, and the passing of all the bills, the federal government actually took control of the LDS Temple in Salt Lake City and control of church properties to break it up. And the church went through a transition there. And after they disavowed polygamy and they became a state, Utah became a state in 1896. The church, there was a big transformation period. There's some excellent books on that. But they became very much more conservative and very much more pro-American. As part of that, to sort of prove their loyalty. The first senators and House of Representative members that were elected were refused to be seated The U.S. Senate wouldn't seat them because they were Mormons. And so they had to prove their loyalty. And a lot of that happened during that 1896 to 1920 period. Prove your loyalty. Prove you're Americans. Prove we can trust you. And they became very much pro-war in the sense of we're going to send our soldiers. We're going to send people in. We're going to prove we're Americans. And now Utah is this ultra-conservative. It's a fascinating study to go across the whole thing.
There's actually a whole unit made of Mormons that marched from Utah down to Mexico for the Mexican War.
That was mainly to raise money.
Yeah.
Well, that's one reason Utah became a state relatively late.
Yes, 1896, when all the other states around them were already, yeah.
I was going to say, there are examples, though, where the Mormon Church wasn't so Pacific. For example, the Mountain Meadows Massacre in the 1870s, things like that.
Late
1850s. 1850s it was.
But that was a small local action, and that's very murky about what happened there. But for the most part, you can be a conscientious objector, and there's no church penalty for that. You're allowed free will and conscience on that. But as a general rule, the church is very nationalistic in that sense, But
didn't Romney get a deferment or something? That's going around.
I know I read something about his time in Paris.
Yeah, he spent 2 years in a mission.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly.
Well, his father was a governor, and that worked pretty much for him like it worked for any other rich and powerful person. I don't think it was much different there.
The divinity got an exemption from the draft, so.
Oh, they all do. How many senators have their sons killed in war and stuff?
What year was it that the Mormon Church disavowed, the mainstream Mormon Church disavowed polygamy?
1890, officially. But there's also a lot of interesting history through that next 20 years about that, too, because there were very high-ranking members of the church who were still authorizing it for a period after that.
That's how Salt Creek was up my camera, but
that's how a lot of the current fundamentalist LDS who still practice down in Cedar City and stuff, it was very murky because there were LDS apostles who were still authorizing polygamous marriages and sealing people and saying it would last forever, and so they carried on with that. And that's why there was just friction between the main body of the Mormon Church and these split-off groups, because there actually is real interesting historical events that happened that, it wasn't as clean a cut as it seems to be.
So there were different degrees of splitting off, and some of the split off groups were still partly attached.
Yeah.
Well, and people were allowed to keep their wives, right, in 1890. They didn't force families apart. So
well, the federal government did.
Right, but they were still sealed altogether.
The church still recognized those marriages, but if you cohabitated, the federal government arrested you.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So it wasn't the dispensation...
It was terrible. The federal government actually broke families apart and broke up their means of support.
They didn't support the women.
No, they really cut them off. And a lot of women suffered, actually, where the federal government supposedly were saving them. But they really cut them off and isolated them. And there was no good transition between them.
No. Could you say a little about Mark Hoffman? What was his influence on church secrecy?
Mark,
do you want to say anything?
You know a lot more about that than
I do. But I do know if you wanted to say anything.
No.
There was a member of the church by the name of Mark Hoffman who was an antiquities dealer. And he actually was pretty good at it.
Well, he was a genius, probably.
Well, and he was legitimate for several years. Yeah. And he was finding old documents and selling them and making money. And then along the way, there were certain... a lot of gaps in Mormon history. Mormon history has really got a wealth of material because they saved it and they believed in that, and journaling and saving. And so there are vaults filled full of things that many other churches don't have. But there were allusions in some of these journals and to other documents that existed that had never been found. And Mark Hoffman started finding them, a high prophet. And he found some things that were... not absolute correlation with church teachings and conflicts and created doubts. And there were even there were investors involved, a lot of money changing hands, and there were shootings, you know, eventually, but with these documents. And it turns out that several of these more controversial ones were forgeries. And actually, if you buy Mormon history books that were printed in the 80s, in the early 90s, they actually reference forged documents because they didn't know. And the FBI eventually had to break it. And Hoffman had actually gone back and found papers and bleached them to take the authentic papers from the period so they would date. And he used ink. He burned ink and put the burned carbon C14 and stuff into the ink he was using so it would date to 1830s and 1840s. And he was a master at forging people's handwriting. And so he created these documents that were very, very difficult to break. And the FBI eventually had to get involved. And it took years to sort it all out.
That's right.
And he's still in prison in Utah because of the crimes he committed.
Right, he got a life sentence.
Yeah.
I guess it's the coup was this, he forged something, New England document.
The Salamander letter.
That and also the Oath of the Free Man.
The Oath of the Free Man, yes. That, which was not a church document, that's a famous American document.
That's right.
He forged that one too, yes.
There's another controversial idea from the Mormon Church is the curse of the dark skin, which was changed with the 1978 revelation. I want to explain that.
Well, part of the Book of Mormon, a big part, is that there are two groups, the Lamanites and the Nephites, after the small group of Jews came from Jerusalem to the New World. There were two brothers that were good, two brothers that were bad, and they split off into two different tribes, and God cursed the bad ones with a dark skin so that they could tell the difference between them. And those were the ones that eventually became the American Indians of today. They overpowered the good ones in the end, and that's what they believe, who they believe the Native Americans are. And that was applied to blacks as well. It was considered to be a curse, the curse of the dark skin on them, and they were actually denied the priesthood until the Revelation 1978.
But the Indians were not.
Right, the Indians were not because, well, they were considered, you know, part of the American, the Book of Mormon's heritage and everything. There was a very big outreach towards them. A lot of proselytizing to them because they were considered part of Mormon history. Mm-hmm. It was also believed that eventually their skin would become lighter as they accepted.
That was taught for a while, although it hasn't been taught in the last 20 years, but it was taught, yes.
Right. In Spencer W. Kimball was the prophet at the time. He received this revelation that blacks were no longer to be denied the priesthood. It was causing a lot of friction at the time for obvious reasons that they were being proselytized through heavily in Africa and other places.
One of the big spots was Brazil.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they would organize these churches, but none of the men could hold the priesthood in them, so they would have to bring white people in from outside to actually administer the churches. They couldn't be the bishop or anything with the Native people there. The Native people couldn't rise to those positions.
Mm-hmm. So that's the source of the line in the song where God changed his mind about black people.
Right.
It is really interesting because there was no actual official doctrine. You know, there's nothing in the DNC that specifically states that.
And more than one black person that was actually given the priesthood.
During Joseph Smith's period, there were at least two men who were given, black men who were given the priesthood with his knowledge. And then when he was killed, but that caused a lot of problem, like in Missouri, and then even at the border of Illinois, which was right across the river from Missouri, there was tremendous pressure, and they were trying to proselyte and, you know, sort of missionaries into these slave zones, and it was causing problems for the church to actually be anti-slavery and probe rights for blacks. And Joseph Smith ran for president in 1844, very briefly, and actually had a presidential platform, which is pretty liberal for the time period. And so there's a lot of real interesting historical digging on that really, there's some doubt about whether Joseph Smith intended blacks to be denied the priesthood. And that it might have been more politically at the time to suppress that and just to wait for some period when they moved to some area where they could do it more openly. But then when he died, his successor, Brigham Young, was much more adamant on that. And he was the one who actually preached and brought out that blacks could not hold the priesthood, and taught it from the pulpit openly. And Joseph Smith never did that. And so Brigham Young actually is the person who instituted that practice on a grand scale,
So although they were anti-slavery, even I'm assuming Brigham Young was anti-slavery.
No, he was not.
Oh, he wasn't. Okay.
Brigham Young had a lot of personal prejudices in that
regard.
He was
very different from Joseph Smith.
Yeah, he was very different. Yes.
Joseph Smith was the one that was anti-slavery.
Yes.
You know very much about the work of the Tanners and their so-called Utah Lighthouse Ministry.
Gerald and Sandra?
Right.
Never heard of
them.
I never heard of Gerald and Sandra Tanner. No, I know them.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, what do you think about their work, writing about exposing the inconsistencies over history and Mormonism and how it's changed with the times and the other work they've done on the subject?
My impression is that they're very evangelically oriented, and so that colors a lot of what they do. I mean, they do have some valid points, but I'm sure, can speak more to that.
Well, I mean, that's true. They are very evangelical Christian. They believe in a young earth. They part of their store is a very fundamentalist form of Christianity. They were members of the church and became disavowed, and their work is very uneven. Uh-huh. Some of their stuff, they bring up very valid points, and they publish things that the church wouldn't want to be published,
right.
And some of them are valid, but other things have been historically incorrect. They were totally, they weren't as taken in as by Hoffman. They didn't trust Hoffman when he came out with that. But many of the things they published were really not well researched.
Uh-huh.
And so... within the church, they get ripped to pieces. People attack their weaknesses, but that doesn't mean they don't have some valid points. But they get caught up in a lot of that controversy. Mm-hmm. They've been at that for 30 or 40 years now. Right. I think they're getting kind of old now, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, they've been around a while.
Yeah, and they're certainly seen as vile characters by members, by the church itself. But
I think they're kind of a convenient straw man as well for the church, that they're easy to attack rather than, say, like D. Michael Quinn and people who do raise a lot of very valid points and are very stringent in their scholarship.
Yeah, you can put like 10 or 15 or 20 or more things against that they published that were false, and you can totally discredit them that way and just paint the whole thing as unreliable.
How about their work on how the Book of Mormon and other writings have been altered over the years? Is that generally accurate or not?
They've had a lot of accuracies there. They've worked with a guy named Marquardt. I can't think of his first name right now, but he's actually very good and very meticulous. And they've worked with a few other people. Some of the stuff they've put out is very well researched.
Right.
Yeah.
How about their allegations that most of Mormon ritual was just lifted from the Freemasons?
Well, a lot of temple ceremonies do seem to be very closely correlated to them.
Right.
I wouldn't say most of ritual, but there are some key ceremonies.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. It sounds like from what we're talking about various professors, that the Mormons tend to be, really up on and accepting science, current science, as opposed to some of the very fundamentalist churches that are kind of disavowing scientific work.
Well, that depends a lot on congregations. Officially, the church has like no position on evolution. In fact, David O. McKay, a former prophet, said things supporting of evolution. And the hard sciences, the church actually has a lot of people in there, very high up.
Some of the professors here at the University of Wisconsin. There was a geology professor here who was world-renowned, who was the counselor in the state presidency.
So there's a lot of, so that just variable between...
Yes. I mean, you go to some small conservative wards, and you'll hear talk against evolution. I grew up with people who talked very poorly against evolution here in Madison. But there are many, many highly regarded professors and things that...
So it's idiosyncratic as opposed to anything, any position that the church takes.
Right. The church is pretty hands-off in regard to that.
Is that Arthur Hassler, the professor you're talking about?
That was David Clark. Okay. But then there was a guy named Jack Staub, you certainly knew.
Yes, I worked for him.
Yeah, and he worldwide expert on cucumbers and
melons
and stuff, and, you know, in the agriculture. And he fully embraced...
He presented to the young adults programs on evolution. Interestingly, his wife is very anti-evolution, and she taught my seminary class was very derogatory towards evolution.
Yeah. Arthur Hassler, he was a limnologist. He was a member of First Unitarian.
I know,
I have a personal experience with a man who was getting his PhD at Iowa State University in 1959. He was a Mormon, and he was his way was being paid by the church, I understand, but at least he was guaranteed a faculty position at Brigham Young University, where he taught then for his whole career. But I had a big argument with him shortly before he finished his PhD, because he didn't believe in evolution. And I said, how can you not believe in evolution and be getting a PhD in botany at Iowa State University? And he finally admitted after a long argument that it's because I'm a Mormon and I choose to not believe in evolution.
But that's interesting, because the church doesn't have a position on it. You can believe in evolution without any consequence.
Brigham Young has classes on evolution.
Yes, it's personal choice.
Right. There are people within the Mormon church that are very adamant against it, and there are groups of people in there. But there's no conflict. Brigham Young teaches classes on evolution.
Yeah, Brigham Young actually has a really strong earth science museum and department.
Yeah.
I've
seen that.
What's dinosaur? What's that? What department is that? I'm drawing a blank right now.
Paleontology.
Very strong in that, because they have all the fossil beds and stuff close by. And they've published in BYU magazine some of their finds. They had a revolutionary discovery a few years ago of finding partial dinosaur DNA in coal.
And finding more feathers.
But they published that because they were getting national acclaim for this research work, and they got thousands and thousands of letters criticizing BYU magazine for daring to publish, from people who, and there was their own scientists, and they said, but people didn't want to hear that BYU was a renowned expert in proving evolution. Yeah.
So they probably don't have an official position on climate change. Is that a little bit like evolution?
The church has made no statement on climate change.
But there's certainly a lot of strong opinion within the church, individuals.
But what would the trends be?
But also, the church, in building church buildings, has gotten far greener in the last 10 to 12 years. But I think that's economics.
Yeah.
But the church, the wards, the buildings, the farms and everything have far more, less energy consumption, much greener than it used to be.
Yeah.
If I can ask one final question, do you want to comment on this book by D. Michael Quinn?
I actually haven't read it, but my father knows him, so.
I do know D. Michael Quinn.
I couldn't get the book from the library.
Right, I can pass it around.
I gather it talks about the time of Joseph Smith and the attitudes of people, the tendency to believe in magic and that sort of thing.
Right. Michael Quinn served as an assistant church historian in the 1970s and under a man named Leonard Arrington. And up to that point, the church had locked a lot of those historical vaults away and never let anybody in them. But the president of the church, Spencer W. Kimball, allowed Leonard Arrington access because they were going to write more accurate histories. And one of the people he employed as an assistant was Mike Quinn, who went into those archives. And Mike Quinn is a brilliant man, and he took copious notes and went on to become a professor at BYU in history. And this book is a result of a lot of his research. He spent years in the vaults taking notes and reading things, and then afterward started publishing, and the church didn't like his candor of publishing some of these events and some of the consequences and links he was coming up with, and they tried to suppress him. And he eventually lost his teaching position at Brigham Young, and he continued to publish a series of these books still based on these notes. He still has notes that he's never published, but he has. But it's fascinating, and it does draw links to early Mormon, what Joseph Smith and early Mormon church members were exposed to in the 1810s and 1820s, and how the folk magic and how these other things influenced Joseph Smith, and it made the church very uncomfortable, and he got in quite a bit of hot water for publishing that book.
Wasn't he excommunicated?
Well, he was, but then the church conveniently found out that he was homosexual, and he is, and he was excommunicated for homosexuality.
Oh.
Not for historical writings.
I was interested to read about the seer stones and the dowsing rods that Joseph Smith and his family used
in their
treasure hunting.
He
talks about that in the book. So,
that's the way he found the attitudes.
That's the way he translated them.
The seer stone was something that he put in his hat, and that would lead him to a place to dig for treasure.
That's right.
I think we should thank our speakers.
Yes.
Draw this formal presentation to a close.